You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, exactly. And troll on in for miles and miles and miles. You know, we have the opportunity every week to talk to folks from the council, from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, some of which have drawn the short straw and had to come on the show over and over again over the years. And we always like it when we hook up, particularly with the experts who are impassioned about how they ended up to be at the council, but more often than not, how they were able to maintain their interest in specific parts of their life. And that's one thing I learned a little bit about Asuka Ishizaki years ago when we met. She is the her title is a protected species coordinator, which means that, you know, she could be a policewoman about what you can and can't do. And obvious, you know what, everything that we talk about on this program, and when I mentioned earlier in this show that we're going to be talking with Asuka, it used to be garbage in, garbage out. If they weren't getting good information was hard to come out of things like surveys and stock assessments and all of that, some of which have to do with protected species. And today we're going to talk about my favorite eating fish, one of the most sought-after fish ever, and this is a shutome or swordfish. And Asuka joins us now because the last time we talked, Asuka was after some stock assessments and other things we're doing way back in May. And a lot of things have happened since then. First of all, happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thanks for having me back.
It's always a pleasure. And, you know, I want to remind everybody how you zeroed in on where you are right now. What was your initial reason why you wanted to be connected to the ocean and particularly protecting stuff?
I was always more interested in the people side of things. Mm-hmm. I got into this line of work through having worked with turtles, but it's really the interesting part to me is that intersect between protecting a species versus protecting people's livelihoods. And mm-hmm. if you can't do the
you
latter,
do both, right?
If you can't do the protecting people's livelihoods mm-hmm. and what affects them, you're mm-hmm. really not going to be able to protect the turtles and the other things.
You know, there are some people that listen to our shows or hear about us or whatever, and they come back from another part of the world where there's just awful things going on, whether it's industrial smoke or, you know, shark fins hanging off rooftops and all that kind of stuff. And we are pretty well, you know, geographically disconnected to everybody. We're right out in the middle of nowhere, and we're pretty restricted in a lot of areas, right? This is obviously something that works. But does it need tweaking from time to time? Is that what we're going to talk about a little?
Yeah, for sure. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on in the swordfish longline fishery here and with respect to the turtle interaction issue that, you know, we've been talking about over the last couple of years.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I like about it is there are a lot of people that didn't really understand what a contribution Hawaii was making to the swordfish industry, to the marketing of this wonderful, flexible fish. And I know that we could scientifically spend a long time of it, but from what I understand, it travels well. It, you know, it's relatively easy to care for once you've caught it. And it is so flexible that restaurants everywhere love it because it lends to sauces and different preparations. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And it freezes well, too.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's another thing.
Yeah, and absolutely. And the Hawaii's swordfish longline fishery here, what we also call the chalicet fishery, same thing, supplies about half of the U.S. domestic.
For the country.
Yeah, the half of the U.S. domestic production of swordfish. So then when the Hawaii swordfish is not available during the season, mm-hmm. then it gets end up supplemented by imports. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important that this fishery operates in Hawaii when the season is up, which is usually this winter, spring period, mm-hmm. To be able to provide all of that swordfish, mainly for that mainland market where swordfish is really processed.
Yeah, and I know right now it's status quo for the time being because of the way the seasons open and close and what the rules are. And I think that this program has actually helped educate people about what an interaction is. You know, and what they thought before was there was a whole bunch of dead turtles or something. And it turns out that when you do this counting, and maybe you could, I don't know, explain why the method is even used. If an animal isn't harmed in any way, why would it even be counted? Well, because it has to be.
Yeah, with turtles, we always count the number of interactions. And in the swordfish fishery, that means a turtle that's hooked or entangled. Mm-hmm. But pretty much every single one of the loggerhead or leatherback or any other turtle species that's caught in the fishery is released alive, and it's handled in a manner that maximizes their survivability afterwards, meaning that you know, their likelihood of surviving after that interaction is pretty high. We still count the number of turtles, but it's important to focus on the fact that these turtles are released alive and in good condition for the most part. And so the population level impact is going to be really small. And even, you know, we're talking about a lot of turtles. We're really talking about, you know, 10 a year, 15 a year, maybe, you know, the last couple of years we've had this kind of an uptick in loggerhead turtle interactions. We're talking about going from an average of, you know, 12, 15 to upward of 30 in that 1 year that we had in 2018 where we had that really big spike.
Yeah, and so, that could be, and we can explain that from a scientific standpoint, what are some of the reasons that could have happened? And maybe it was certain parts of the ocean were hotter or cooler than before, and different things go to different places, and maybe in that year there were more of those individuals in that area than before, so there are obviously more interactions. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, we had the Science Center, the NOAA Science Center here, take a look at it to see, did the fishery change where they were? You know, what's going on? And they really couldn't find anything. And the only thing that they could really link it back to, it's really a correlation, so we don't know if it's a cause and effect. But the last 10 years or so, the loggerhead turtle nesting, which all happens in Japan, has seen a big spike.
Sure.
The turtles that we see, the loggerhead turtles that we see in the swordfish fishery is about 6 to 10 years old, still juvenile.
Wow, okay.
And so it matches up, the timing matches up. So we're thinking that it's partly, in part, due to that recruitment pulse in the population now starting to get into the area overlapping with the swordfish fishery where their fishing grounds are.
Okay, you know, one of the questions that always comes up, and I've never answered it properly, so you're going to, is when you talk about shallow set and the long line and everything. We do know that turtles need to breathe, you know, and so that must mean that where they're being caught, can they still somehow breathe?
Absolutely. You know? And that's the beauty of the swordfish fishery is that they set their gear shallow, which is why we call it the shallow set long line fishery. So even if they're hooked or entangled, they can still come up to the surface while the gear is deployed.
That's what I'm getting
at. That's why. Right. And so when the gear is brought back on board or brought back to the vessel and they're retrieving the gear, then the turtles will come back alive. That's why they can then release them alive.
Right. And you know what, gang? This is amazing because of the equipment that's been you know, developed over the years to handle that. And a lot of people don't even understand it because when they say long line, shallow set or deep set, doesn't matter. Long line is long, exactly what it is. It's a long line. And they're worried about how many hooks there are on it. And it's not a wall of death. In other words, there's not 10 million hooks in one place. So some people say, all right, that must mean that it has kind of a long enough leader on it so that if a turtle gets entangled or hooked, that, like you said, because it's a shallow set, it can get up to the surface and breathe.
Absolutely.
And so when let's say that I've just set this my line, and now I'm starting to retrieve it. And obviously it takes a long time to set it, a long time to retrieve it. Are they pretty resilient with how long they can be entangled before they get released?
It seems to be. There's been a lot of studies, especially with loggerhead turtles and the smaller turtles, to put tags on them after they're released and see how they do afterwards. And
based on
that, that's how we know they have a pretty high survivability. So these turtles are pretty resilient.
They wouldn't want to get hooked twice, would they?
We had one turtle that had got flipper tagged and then subsequently got caught again.
I would have said, didn't you learn something, my little friend? Let me release you.
You would hope. But yeah, so that's the good thing. They are pretty resilient critters. And, you know, even though they might have been hooked, they just kind of hang around. Presumably, we don't really know. But then once the fishermen can get to it, the observers can get to it and release them, they're usually on their way.
Okay, now talk about that for a minute, too, because of the hooks that were developed for our fishery. Makes that possible. I mean, you know, it's obviously a lot easier to get one of those hooks out than it would be if it was a barbed hook and has to be somehow cut out. But how is it physically done so that people get an idea? I know that sometimes there's just a stick. You can put it out there and and retrieve it. But do some of these actually get up to where the guy retrieving the thing has to get involved physically and remove it himself?
Yeah, so the hook that they're required to use is called a circle hook. It does have a barb.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
but
right.
what it did is that it's a large circle hook so that it's harder for them to swallow it.
Okay.
And so that means when it does get hooked, it's usually hooked somewhere in the mouth area, which makes it a lot easier to handle. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can pull out. Sometimes they have to cut the hook and all of that. And so they have a lot of different tools. They have bolt cutters. They have D-hookers.
Yeah.
They have all these different tools.
I've seen
tools
the D-hookers. They're fascinating.
Yeah, it's like a pigtail-looking thing. And all of that helps. Them safely remove the hook, both for not just for the turtle, but also for the crew that's handling
sure.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, because by the way, a big loggerhead or any turtle is a big turtle. You know, you don't want to get involved with them if you don't have to.
Yeah, fortunately, with the loggerheads in the shallow set fishery, we're looking at maybe like a 60 centimeter, 50 centimeter. Mm. So 2 feet in the shell size, so it's not completely
not
an
the big
adult.
Monsters.
Not
yeah,
the big
yeah,
monsters,
yeah,
but yeah. they do deal with the leatherbacks, which are the large black-looking turtles.
Right.
Those
they get real
they typically
big. Yeah.
See the really big ones,
yeah.
and so they can't bring those on board, so they have to deal with those on the side of the vessel. Mm. Which is another interesting thing is that we tend to see. Even
oh yeah,
though
wait,
all
wait,
of
wait.
Those,
no, wait,
yeah.
but let's back up. Let's make sure you get it. A lot of these boats, whether they're side set or back set or whatever, depending on how they deploy their gear, what Asuka's talking about is they're actually going to bring this turtle that's ensnared or entangled up on the deck. And they're going to either put a towel over its head so it doesn't get all freaky or something, going to do its thing and then release it again.
Except you know, if yeah. it's too big to bring it on board,
right.
which leatherbacks tend to be.
Mm-hmm.
So what they end up having to do is deal with it on the side of the vessel. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, the observer's also trying to take a skin sample for genetic studies and other things.
Yeah.
And while they're handling it, the turtle ends up snapping the line or, you know, they make a sudden movement that snaps the line and goes with mm-hmm. some trailing gear. Or, you know, they're trying to get the turtle away as quickly as possible and end up releasing that turtle with a little bit more line attached than, you know, they should. And
yeah,
so,
and one question also, and I know that people love to hear this, and I try to make sure people understand this. When you talk about the hook, it's evolved a little bit. So, I mean, it's not quite the same as it used to be. But if you do have to cut a hook out, aren't they such that after not too long a period of time, they will actually literally dissolve?
No, we don't have that for the swordfish fishery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they are still using
regular
kind of hooks,
okay.
just larger circle hooks.
Okay.
Yeah, so what that trailing gear on that leatherback is assumed to do is that then if you have this line that's trailing, eventually it has the potential to tangle up with the animal.
Of course, yeah.
And so that contributes to a potential higher mortality rate that's assigned to that turtle. Mm. And so that's when you go back and evaluate, okay, what does that interaction mean to the population? Then that gets scored higher in terms of the risk.
Okay, you mentioned something earlier, which I think it'd be really cool to know. First of all, gang, the sword fishery, the shallow set sword fishery, unlike some of the other boats in the longline fleet, there is an observer on every trip, you know, which makes it a little bit different than the tuna boats because that's every so many trips or whatever. But isn't it also interesting that, like you said, they are multitasking. So they're doing other scientific stuff. And I don't know if we know all of it, but that is measurements and skin samples and all of these kind of things. So it must be the observer, when there's been an interaction, gets pretty busy.
Yep, absolutely. And it's also, you know, the responsibility of the operator, the captain,
mm-hmm.
And the crew to deal with those interactions as
yeah.
well. That's why the captains and the owners have to go and attend the Protected
oh,
Species
that's cool.
workshop
yeah.
every year mm-hmm. to get trained and make sure they're refreshed on that information. But the observers help out, too, to remind them this is what you should do, this is how you can handle it, that sort of thing. And
yeah.
there's certainly a relationship there, too.
Okay, so for those, Asuka, that don't know how it operates, when you say there's a certain allotment or a certain number of interactions that happen, and then after that, the season is done. Now, for instance, let's go back to earlier in 2019. It's in January, right? And it went for like 3 months. And that was during that three-month period, they had that specific number of interactions. It says, okay, gang, we're closed for the year.
Yeah, so that's called what we call a hard cap. Mm-hmm. And so that's a measure that's been in place since 2004. That's a measure that the council implemented.
Yeah. Yeah.
And up until recently, that number was 34 loggerheads in a year.
Okay.
And that's been in place since about 2012. What happened, though, is there was an outstanding litigation against the National Marine Fisheries Service, the federal branch that implements the measures that the mm-hmm. council recommends. Mm-hmm. There's a litigation that finally got resolved in the Ninth Circuit in December of 2017. When that happened, after that, the federal government and the plaintiffs, the environmental NGOs, went and settled. And mm-hmm. as part of that settlement, they said, you need to reduce the number of loggerhead turtles interactions, the hard cap, to 17.
Reduced from 34
on what we started with back in 2004. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't to say that 34 was necessarily a bad number. The whole crux of that litigation was that the analysis that went into that determining that 34 was... the analysis was flawed. And so it's not necessarily the number that's flawed, it was the analysis that's flawed. And so that's why the fishery had to deal with 17 last year. They ended up having doing pretty good for the first couple of months, and all of a sudden a March came around, and there was a period where a lot of vessels just started to hit loggerheads all at once, and then it just tripped them up, exceeded 17, and then they had to close. One thing that's really important is that in the last couple of years, we've also had new scientific information on how the population is doing, the loggerhead population is doing, and they're actually increasing at 2% per year.
Yeah, I was hoping that. Now, it may not seem like a lot, but when we're talking about the interesting way that science can estimate how many are out there and everything else, and I do know that there's a lot of other conditions that the public is becoming aware of, which don't really all factor into this, but we talk about global warming and rising seas, and sometimes these turtles and I are turning up in pretty interesting places. Like, didn't we have a loggerhead come up and give birth here?
That was Olive Ridley.
That's right, and it was like on Lanikai Beach or something. Or it was on a beach.
Kailua, I think. Kailua. Yeah, on that
when all of a sudden people said, hey, wow, look. And you know, and that just says that, you know, Mother Nature figures out a way to do what she's got to do. And you know, everybody gave them a big wide berth. But so there are other factors now, right, that are being taken into considerations in some of these rulings to, you know, look, if the population is increasing, this is good. You know, we want to see these things increase.
Yeah, and
it's not all doom and gloom, right?
Yeah, and that's where I think we need to be heading in terms of looking at how do we set these limits such that they're consistent with the cap. Now, so what's happened since then is we've seen that higher number of interactions. The council over the last couple of years have been dealing with that information and said, okay, how do we deal with that?
Yeah.
And so what we saw in that a patch of higher interactions in 2018 was there were a small number of vessels that ran into a large number of loggerheads.
No.
So even though we don't know why. But you know, it could be that they just happened to be in a really high loggerhead area. It could have been somebody else as well. We don't know. We don't make that judgment. But even though we've had that fleet-wide cap, the council realized that there wasn't an individual accountability to each one of those vessels.
Okay, now that makes a lot of sense because obviously, and really doesn't it also depend on where the skipper wants to take a boat? I mean, he might be going to a part of the ocean known for these turtles.
And or known for the swordfish,
And so it's more likely. It's more likely that they care about the swordfish.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and where are
they? We really hadn't had a loggerhead problem. We had a number of years where the number of loggerhead turtle was interactions were low, and so it probably wasn't something that they were paying too much attention to, which was a good thing for a long time until all of a sudden they started running into a lot of turtles. And so what the council ended up doing was to develop a measure called the trip limit, which means that in addition to having a fleet limit, that there would be individual limits on the number of interactions a vessel can have in any given trip.
Okay, so that's, and that makes a lot of sense. And I think maybe one of the reasons for that is because different skippers and different owners have different ways to do the fishery. They're not all fishing with each other. They don't call each other up and say, hey, there's plenty of fish over here, come get yours. It's pretty much these are individuals that may or may not see anybody during the whole trip. But isn't it true that some of these boats, for whatever the reason, where they go have more interactions than others?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And so that's what the council recognized. The other thing that council recognized, too, in developing that measure was we really haven't seen a vessel hit loggerheads over and over and over again, that it's probably something with a condition or just where they were. So you don't necessarily want to penalize them too much by having had that one trip where they had a lot of loggerheads. And so the idea was that, okay, if you have five loggerhead interactions in a trip, which is a lot more than the average, typically if they... the average trip they have zero, right?
Yeah,
and so
if they have, make sure you know that, by the way, these guys, it's a tough life. I mean, they're not in town for too long. During the season, they can't make any money at the dock. So they come in, they got mechanical stuff done, they get medical stuff done to some of the crew, and boom, they load up and stuff, and they go back out again.
Yeah, so if they do have an interaction, it's usually one. Mm-hmm. But occasionally they might have one where they start racking them up relatively quickly early on in the trip. Mm-hmm. So if they have five,
what
if they're getting close to five, the idea was then, okay, when you hit five, you have to come back to port.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because usually, especially early in the season, they're fishing well close to 1,000 miles out, you know, somewhere in the 500 nautical mile to 1,000 nautical miles out from port. And so it takes a while for them to steam out to the fishing ground. So that
creates that
economic incentive to say, okay, I'm starting to have a lot of loggerheads here. How do I avoid that?
Yeah.
And it puts that onus on that operator and allows that operator to then say, okay, how do I make sure I don't hit that so I can continue to fish and not have to go back.
Yeah, and so a lot of these guys, by the way, I know they keep grids of where the action is, and these are very secret things that they use. And some of them might just say, hey, you know what, pull it up, we got to go, we got to move. You know, here's the thing, that and when you say that's thousands of miles, those of you that have been down to Pier 38, where most of our longline vessels are part of the HLA, Hawaii Longline Association, when you look at these things and you go aboard and you walk around, they're pretty tough. These are big. They're not very big when you take them 1,000 miles away. They're small. There's no grocery stores. There's no nothing. And so that means if somebody has to react to a lot of interactions where they want it to be, they might have to spend a lot of fuel and a lot of time going somewhere else. That impacts their financial stability too, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So what the council then did was to recommend those trip limits as far back as June of 2018, and then the council came back and recommended that again in April, and then also recommended new hard caps for loggerheads and leatherbacks. Now, at the time, the council was also waiting for the NOAA fishery, the National Marine Fisheries Service, to finish a document called the biological opinion.
Okay.
Which is something
biological opinion.
The biological opinion. We call it the BIOP for short.
Gotcha.
And it's done for the purpose of evaluating impacts under the Endangered Species Act, the act that protects turtles. And so we were waiting on that. The council was waiting on it and said, okay, we'll see what it comes out with to make sure that our impacts are small enough. And if there's any additional measures that's going to be required as part of that BIOP, the council will consider that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I came back, came and talked to you back in May,
we were waiting for the numbers, right? There you go.
Exactly.
Now, that's a great, and that's one of the reasons why we're here today, gang, because Asuka and I thought we better talk about that, because May, everybody was waiting for this piece of work, and then how did everybody react to it, and what impact did it have? That's what, now that's what you're going to learn.
Yeah. So the document finally came out in June, and then the council ended up considering that at an intersessional meeting in August. Mm-hmm. So in that document that came out in June, the number of interactions that the fishery is likely to have, the loggerhead turtle number was 36, the leatherback was 21, but a couple of additional things happened in that document. One was that it said for leatherback turtles, because they're not doing as well as loggerheads are, the limit needs to be set well below that 21.
Oh boy.
It needs to be set at 16.
Okay.
The other thing that happened was they didn't say anything about loggerhead limit. So they left that one alone, which meant that the council had the ability to adjust it every which way they needed.
Yeah.
And then the third thing that happened is said, you need to go and do these trip limits, but not just the way that the council considered it, but also add these backstops. Meaning
what is that? What does that mean?
I've
heard that being said. I talked to a captain and said, is the backstops or what are killing me? What is that?
So the backstop is what... essentially it's written as if a vessel hits a trip limit twice in a calendar year, then they're out for the entire calendar year,
right.
The rest of the calendar,
calendar year. Right now, gang, the season and the calendar year, don't mix them up. Because last year, I think the season was from January to March or April. I mean, it was 3 months.
Yeah. And so, and then there's an additional kicker in addition to that, which is that that particular vessel, then also the following year has an annual limit of 5 loggerheads or 2
wow.
leatherbacks. And so that trip limit becomes like an annual maximum limit. And so the council then took that information and considered it at the August meeting. The council really considered those backstops to be a really conservative measure. It's too much because
maybe
we haven't
much.
Seen
yeah.
it. The
yeah.
loggerheads especially are doing well. Leatherbacks maybe, but still, you know, we really haven't seen a lot of leatherbacks in a single trip. And so... and we haven't had a lot of leatherback interactions to begin with. And so the council considered and really had a hard time deciding what to do going forward because they understood all of these nuances. But at the same time, if the council didn't act consistent with that biological opinion, then NOAA Fisheries would have done it anyway.
And you know what, gang? Here's where it's very, very important to understand what the role of the council is and who it's a semi quasi-government group, but it has stakeholders from throughout our area, in particular this district, who really lend their expertise or their knowledge so that, because nobody wants Asuka to paint NOAA as Big Bad NOAA, but they have to operate based on the science that they're using, right? And isn't it possible that they're now getting science that is more valuable, and it's somewhat possible that the members of the council, particularly the fishermen, realize that nobody's out to get them, but you have to fight for your rights. You have to fight for your numbers.
Yeah, and the other good thing about the council is it's a public process. So when the
council met back in August,
you know, it was open to the public. Anybody could come in, listen in, and provide their public comment. And so we went through that process. But at the end of the day, the council didn't have a whole lot of choice but to accept those mitigation measures and go forward. So the council took that final action in August.
Okay.
Now we are heading into January 1. So the fishery
coming
still,
up. That's when it's
that's
gonna
coming
open.
Up. Right. And the fishery's been closed since March. Mm. It's been 4 months.
Should
since
be a lot of
council.
Fish out there. I think. I hope. Yeah.
There's, you know, it's been 4 months since the council took action. Unfortunately, it takes time for that council recommendation to go through the review, go through proposed rule, the rulemaking phase, and before it's implemented.
So does that mean that, for all intents and purposes, there's not going to be any significant change in 2020?
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah.
So the trip limits won't go in yet. So the one of the things that the council did as part of that August action is to say, because there's those backstops, because there's those additional conservation measures, we are not going to set a fleet limit on the loggerhead turtle. And so the council did that as well. So because those rules aren't going to go in on January 1, they will have to deal with 17 loggerheads again. They won't have trip limits to deal with that individual accountability issue. So that's where we are. That's where the fishery is going to start on January 1.
Okay, so that being said, I just want to remind us again what happens after the closure. Because we supply a huge percentage of shutomi or broadbill swordfish to the market. I mean, very, very high percentage. And that simply means after that, when you create a demand and you reduce the supply, that you have to be careful of where you're getting your swordfish when you're not catching our fish. I mean, and I don't mean to say anything bad about that, but doesn't it sometimes travel a lot longer and maybe be frozen more? You know what I'm talking about? There are some risks that you're not getting the same quality fish.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for us in Hawaii, even if the swordfish fishery is closed, there is a small number of swordfish that comes in through the tuna fishery.
Yeah, there you go.
And so you may still see swordfish on the market at the grocery store that's from here during off season. So that's a good thing. But for purposes of supplying it to the mainland, they need the volume, right, to be able to send it to the markets. And so that's
more important, Asuka, from the commercial standpoint, which I hear from my guys all the time, and that is, it's hard to get a customer.
Yeah.
Yep. And once you have a customer, you need to really supply that guy because you're only as good as the last fish you sent me, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so we definitely heard that from the industry folks that, you know, it really affects their market reliability as well.
Well, I think it's very important that we realize that this is a work in progress and that and so we don't know, knock on wood, how long it's going to take. And there's no reason that it's only going to be 3 months, right? It can be...
Yeah, if you know, the loggerhead numbers are lower than 17, then they can continue to fish. And so what we're doing right now is to get the word out into the industry and say, this is what we think the outlook is for 2020. We think the rulemaking for this rule is going to start early 2020 in January or so, which means that it'll take from 4 to 5 months from there before it's implemented if the council's recommendations are approved as is.
Okay.
So we're looking, that also means that their entire season, which start to taper off in April and May, probably means they're going to deal with 17. So we're trying to get that word out, trying to get some additional information out to them about how they might be able to avoid loggerheads to help them stay under that 17.
Yeah, and that's terrific. And that's the thing that we'll try to keep you up to speed on. And I think, you know, you should be fairly optimistic that, you know, at least there's a lot of stakeholders in doing it. And I guess that maybe what we can really hope for is that during the calendar year of 2020, things will fall into place where we can take a look at, all right, maybe in 2021 we can do the thing. But here's what everybody asked, and I don't want to, and you may not know all the answer to this, but a lot of these boats that fish in the sword fishery are 3 or 4 months into fishing. Now there's you know, eight or nine more months in the year. These boats don't use the same gear. They'll come back and they'll retool for something else. So it's not as though all of these boats are prevented from fishing after they've reached the quota.
That's right. Yeah. And that's the fortunate thing about our fishery is that they can switch back
flexible.
And forth
go
between the shallow set gear and go deep set with tuna. But then at the same time, you know, if you want that, if there's, you know, the component of the industry that really wants to keep that swordfish, Hawaii swordfish product alive. And so that's where I think the interest is in keeping that fishery alive.
Okay, so now you're a little bit up to speed on the Shutome. And we had a lot to cover, and we want to thank Asuka Ishizaki, the protected species the coordinator, for her time. And we're actually going to have, this is part one of two. What are we going to do next week?
Next week, we'll talk a little bit more about what's happening, what else is happening in 2020, and we'll talk a little bit more about the small boat.
There you go. And that's what we want to do. All right. And remember, if you want to hear something on the program, drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Or if you want to find out about Asuka's place and everybody else, go to wpcouncil.org. It's so much better now. They're spending a lot of time on that website. There's really great stuff, especially if you're a teacher, to go check out. So thanks for being here. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, go out and catch some fish and have a good time. Aloha.